Welcome to the first episode of Portraits of the Blue and Gray, the biographical Civil War podcast. As the name suggests, this podcast will focus on the lives of the greatest and most interesting figures connected to the United States Civil War. The plan is to alternate each episode between North and South, matching up more or less comparable figures. Our first episode will be a two-parter or maybe more on probably the second most recognizable figure from the Civil War era, behind only Abraham Lincoln, and that is Confederate General Robert E. Lee. We're starting with Lee for a few reasons. First, he's one of the best-known figures on either side. There's a reason that when South Park parodied Civil War reenactments, one of the characters went by the alias General Cartman Lee. Also, because Lee was a high-level commander, studying his career will give us a bird's-eye view of the progression of the war, particularly the Eastern Theater. Not to worry, though, we'll have plenty of time to look at the Western Theater in upcoming episodes, such as our second episode, which will be on U.S. Grant. Then, with the overall outline established, we can look at more of the details of the fighting in future episodes. Also, Lee survived the war, and he had a long career before its start, which will again provide us with a little bit more perspective. All of these factors make Lee an intriguing figure worth closer inspection, and a good starting point for our biographical survey of the Civil War era. So with that said, let's begin our portrait of Robert E. Lee, Part 1. Imagine you live in England just before the Brexit vote. Now, you don't agree with Brexit. Maybe you even work for the EU. You think that all Europeans are benefiting from the European Union and that it's a mistake for Britain to leave. The vote comes, and you're disappointed with the results, but you never seriously consider renouncing your British citizenship. After all, you identify much more as an Englishman or woman, or as a Brit, than as a European or as a citizen of the EU. Now, let's push this exercise into a bit more hypothetical territory and imagine that the EU fundamentally rejects the Brexit vote and announces that it will be sending an army into Britain with the stated purpose of preserving the European Union and subjugating the British Rebellion. Would you fight against the EU occupation of England, even though you didn't support Brexit in the first place? Now, I fully recognize that this is an imperfect analogy for a few reasons. The EU can't claim to be a sovereign state in the way that the antebellum United States could, and there's no moral elephant in the room like slavery present. Nonetheless, I think that this exercise is illustrative of the way that a Southerner, and more importantly, a Virginian, like Robert E. Lee, would have viewed the question of secession and the impending war over it in early 1861. Like many Americans of the time, especially in the South, Lee viewed himself more as a citizen of his state than as an American. His family had been in Virginia for a couple hundred years at that point, longer than the United States had even existed. Personally, he thought secession was a bad idea, and that it was going to end in disaster. But his personal sense of duty and honor compelled him to loyalty to what he saw as his homeland. And that was Virginia, not the United States. The Lees of Virginia were descended from a distinguished English family, with an ancestor who had accompanied William the Conqueror in his Norman invasion of England in 1066. Richard Lee founded the family in Virginia in the 1600s. Richard had been a supporter of the English monarchy during the reign of Charles I, and in all likelihood, he sought refuge in Virginia, like many other Cavaliers, as the king's supporters were called, after the defeat of the king's forces in the English Civil War. So if you've ever wondered why the University of Virginia's athletic teams are known as the Cavaliers, this is why. Members of the Lee family had signed the Declaration of Independence and fought in the Revolutionary War, including Robert E. Lee's father, General Henry Light Horse Harry Lee. Light Horse Harry had been celebrated for his fighting in the Southern Theater of the Revolutionary War against British General Cornwallis and his cavalry commander, Bannister Tarleton. You'll probably remember Tarleton as the villain in Mel Gibson's movie The Patriot. Light Horse Harry graduated from the College of New Jersey, now known as Princeton, in 1773, and was soon a young officer serving in the Continental Army under General George Washington. By age 20, he was a captain in the 1st Continental Light Dragoons and had obtained the rank of major by 23. It was around that time that he led a daring late-night raid on the British at Paulus Hook in New Jersey, which earned him another promotion to lieutenant colonel, a medal for valor from Congress, and a transfer down south to join Nathaniel Greene's forces in the Carolinas. While down south, Light Horse Harry fought with distinction at the battles at Camden and Guilford Courthouse before moving north to Virginia to participate in the decisive victory at Yorktown. Letters from Generals Greene and Washington testify to the high esteem that they had for Henry Lee. And Light Horse Harry wrote the famous eulogy of General Washington, describing him as, quote, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, unquote. After the war, Light Horse Harry served in Congress and as governor of Virginia, and was also a tobacco planter. Robert Edward Lee was born at the Stratford Hall Plantation in Westmoreland County, Virginia, on January 19, 1807, to Light Horse Harry and his second wife, Anne Hill Carter. Westmoreland County had been the birthplace of several other famous Virginians, including George Washington and James Monroe. Light Horse Harry didn't play much of a part in Robert's childhood, though Lee did always defend his father and published Light Horse Harry's memoirs during his time at Washington College after the war. Now, despite his prominent name and connections, Light Horse Harry ran into some severe financial problems, which resulted mostly from poor investments. These problems eventually landed him in debtor's prison and resulted in the seizure of much of his assets, including the medal that he had been awarded by Congress after Paulus Hook. In 1812, Light Horse Harry was severely injured in mob violence in Baltimore. He and a friend were savagely beaten by an angry mob due to their opposition to the War of 1812. During the attack, the mob poured melted candle wax on his eyes, sliced him up with knives, and even tried to cut off his nose. Light Horse Harry was left disfigured and with permanently slurred speech for the rest of his life. In 1813, he left his family for Barbados. Robert was 5 at the time. Harry had hoped that the warmer climate in the Caribbean would aid his recovery, but unfortunately that was not to be. He died on Cumberland Island off the Georgia coast in 1818 during what was supposed to be his return trip to Virginia. Robert was 11 when he learned of his father's death. As a child, Lee attended Eastern View, which was a school for young gentlemen in Fauquier County, Virginia, followed by Alexandria Academy, so he was well educated, as was very important to his mother. She also emphasized discipline, as she did not want to see Light Horse Harry's weaknesses repeated in her children. Robert took his mother's lessons to heart, as he reportedly never drank, swore, or gambled, unless you count the somewhat risky military maneuvers for which he would later become known. Young Robert Lee was well-rounded in his interests. He enjoyed swimming, hiking, horseback riding, and intellectual pursuits such as the study of philosophy. Growing up, he would certainly have enjoyed some benefits from coming from a well-known family, but he did not grow up wealthy. His mother largely had to rely on the hospitality and generosity of relatives to support her children. One of the highlights of Lee's adolescence was when he had the opportunity to meet the Marquis de Lafayette. This occurred during the Frenchman's return tour of the United States. Lafayette had made a point of visiting the widow of Light Horse Harry, with whom he had served during the Revolutionary War. In 1824, William Henry Fitzhugh, who was a relative of Lee's mother, wrote to Secretary of War John C. Calhoun requesting Lee's appointment to the United States Military Academy at West Point. Lee reportedly delivered the letter in person at Fitzhugh's insistence. Now, he had to wait a year due to the surplus of cadets that had been admitted, but in the summer of 1825, Lee began his career at West Point. At the time, the curriculum of West Point focused on engineering, and the supervisor of the school was the head of the Army Corps of Engineers. By all accounts, Lee was a dedicated and successful student at West Point. He excelled in math, and again enjoyed philosophy while famously finishing his 4 years without receiving a single demerit and graduating second in his class, behind only Charles Mason, who would resign his officer's commission after a year as an instructor at West Point and go on to become the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Iowa. After his graduation, Lee returned to Virginia to sadly find his mother on her deathbed. Anne Hill Carter Lee passed away on July 26, 1829, when her son Robert was 22. While back in Virginia, Lee had begun courting Mary Custis, who was the daughter of the wealthy George Washington Parke Custis. She was also the great-granddaughter of Martha Washington, but not of George. Her ancestor was Martha's first husband, Daniel Parke Custis. After beginning his active duty service, Lee continued to write to Mary Custis. He asked her to marry him, but she declined his first proposal, due in part to her father's disapproval, which arose from his perception of Lee's being unworthy of his daughter due to Light Horse Harry's fall from grace. In 1830, she changed her mind with her father's consent, and they were married on June 30th, 1831. Together, they'd go on to have 7 children, 3 boys and 4 girls. All 3 of their sons would serve as officers in the Confederate Armed Forces. 2 would reach the rank of Major General, and 1 was a captain. Lee's initial commission was as a second lieutenant in the Army Corps of Engineers. His first assignment was in Cockspur Island, Georgia, where he was sent to assist in the construction of a fort that would protect the mouth of the Savannah River. The construction plans for the fort were determined to be unworkable, and Lee was then reassigned to Fort Monroe in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia in 1831, where he served as an engineer until 1834. After his time at Fort Monroe, Lee was transferred to Washington, where he would serve as the assistant to Brigadier General Charles Gatrio. While Lee was stationed in Washington, he and his family lived at the Custis family estate in nearby Arlington, Virginia. That plantation would be the future site of Arlington National Cemetery. The land would be commandeered by Union forces during the Civil War, though the Lee family did eventually receive payment for the real estate from the federal government in the 1880s. Lee's time in Washington was fairly uneventful, other than an expedition to survey the Michigan-Ohio border. After receiving a promotion to first lieutenant, Lee supervised several engineering projects on the Mississippi River, which earned him a promotion to captain in 1842. After that promotion, he was assigned as the post engineer to Fort Hamilton in New York. The peacetime army and his engineering position hadn't really provided Lee with the kind of opportunities for rapid advancement that his father had enjoyed. He was growing frustrated at the slow progression and often found himself outranked by men with lesser service time. At one point, he wrote to a friend, quote, "I am waiting, looking, hoping for some good opportunity to bid an affectionate farewell to my dear Uncle Sam," unquote. So anyone who has ever been stuck in a dead-end job but not quite ready to risk leaving can relate to how Lee must have been feeling at the time. Or more cynically, you might say that had Lee found the opportunity for his affectionate farewell at that time, then his eventual separation from service with the United States Army would most likely have been on better terms. But Lee was about to find ample opportunities to prove his merit. The Mexican-American War broke out in 1846, which brought an end to the time of Lee's quiet service as an engineer. Lee was assigned to serve under General John Wool, who was leaving for Mexico from San Antonio, Texas. Lee was still in Washington at the time, and he was afraid that Wool would begin his march before Lee could join him. Lee traveled by steamboat to New Orleans, and then to the Texas Gulf Coast, and then by horseback to San Antonio to join Wool. In all, he had traveled about 2,500 miles in 3 weeks, which was making really good time by the standards of the day, and he arrived in San Antonio with a full week to spare. Upon his arrival in San Antonio, his first assignment was to act as a purchasing agent. He would procure tools and equipment to build a pontoon bridge across the Rio Grande, and he also commissioned some local workmen to construct the 4 large wooden pontoons that would be needed for the bridge. When the army did reach the Rio Grande, Lee supervised the construction of the bridge, which was across the river's around 300 yards span. The U.S. forces had hoped that upon arriving in Mexico, they would be viewed as liberators by the local population. This was due to the deep racial divides in Mexican society. The ruling class was almost exclusively the white descendants of the Spanish conquerors, while the vast majority of the population consisted of natives. And this divide was mirrored in the officers and enlisted men in the Mexican military. Waddy Thompson, who was the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, had written, quote, "The aristocracy of color is quite as great in Mexico as in this country," unquote. However, the U.S. forces would be greatly disappointed. They had probably been a bit overly optimistic, and there was no local support forthcoming. So without support from the locals and lacking any really adequate topographical maps, the Army had to lean heavily on its engineers during the 600-mile march towards the Mexican fort in Chihuahua. Lee's team was charged with supervising the construction of the roads and the temporary bridges that the Army would need during its trip. Now, for the most part, the long march went without incident. But then on Christmas Day of 1846, General Wool received word that Mexican troops had been spotted moving nearby. So Lee volunteered to serve as a scout, tasked with finding the Mexican army's precise location. He hired a local guide, and they ventured out into the rugged mountainous terrain. When he and his guide were about 40 miles away from Wool's army, they spotted some campfires and believed that they had located their objective. But before going back, Lee wanted to make sure, so he moved closer. But his guide was reasonably concerned about what the consequences might be if they were captured, and so he left Lee to conduct the surveillance on his own. So Lee moved closer to observe what he believed to be some tents near the campfires, but found that the white patches he had thought were tents from a distance were in fact sheep. And the campfires had not been made by Mexican soldiers, but by a group of local shepherds. Lee approached the shepherds, and using the limited Spanish that he had at his command, he was able to discern the general whereabouts of the Mexican army. And he then headed back to rejoin his own group. Lee reported his findings to Wool and was then sent back out, this time with a cavalry team, and a mission of plotting the Mexican army's exact location and numbers, which they were able to do successfully. Lee's accomplishments as a scout earned him a promotion to Inspector General of his division, and then a transfer to serve on the staff of General Winfield Scott, who was the overall commander of all U.S. forces in Mexico. And that was a position that he would continue to hold up through the very beginning of the Civil War. Lee had met Scott a few years earlier, when both men had been temporarily stationed at West Point in 1844 to assist in administering the exams to cadets. Scott remembered Lee and then personally selected him to join his staff, which was quite an honor for Lee at the time. Like Lee, Scott was a Virginian, though he would remain loyal to the Union 15 years later. Scott had an impressive resume and seems to have made quite an impression on Lee. Scott had studied to be a lawyer at the College of William and Mary, but instead opted for the military life. He rose through the ranks from a Virginia militia corporal all the way up to brigadier general by the end of the War of 1812, and he had been wounded in that war. Also, like Lee, Scott was known to excel in scholarship. He had written two books on infantry tactics that were widely used throughout the U.S. Army, and he'd also translated some of the writings of Napoleon from the original French. Writing of Scott, author Martin Dugard writes, quote, "As the Mexican War began, Scott had been a general for three decades. No one in the U.S. Army, not even Zachary Taylor, possessed such standing. Scott had all but forgotten what it felt like to hold a lesser rank," unquote. Now, Lee, along with fellow staff member George McClellan, ended up serving what amounted to an apprenticeship in military leadership and planning under Scott. McClellan went so far as to mimic the Napoleonic pose that Scott struck during his portraits. And they also both learned from Scott the importance of obtaining as much intelligence about the enemy as possible before engaging in battle. The Veracruz invasion that Scott was planning would be, at the time, the largest amphibious landing in American history. So the logistical challenge presented by this endeavor were enormous. They were required to coordinate the transportation of 10,000 men on ships, along with the arms, ammunition, cannons, and horses that were needed to support them. You really have to think that 15 years later, when McClellan was planning the Peninsula campaign and the amphibious landing involved with that, that he must have been thinking about Scott planning Veracruz. Perhaps he was inspired by his former mentor. Veracruz would be the first time that Lee experienced hostile fire. The landing began on March 6, 1847. They had anticipated that they would run into some heavy fighting on the beach, but instead they met only token resistance while the Mexican army prepared to defend from behind the walls of a nearby castle. Scott didn't want to risk having a Mexican army in his rear as he advanced, so he decided to lay siege to the castle. And during the siege, Lee was given command of an artillery battery. Lee was shot at in a friendly fire incident during the siege, but he escaped with only some damage to his coat. And after a few days of the heavy fire from the American artillery and the naval guns, the castle was surrendered. After the surrender, Scott personally commended Lee for noble service, and Lee received a promotion to senior engineer. Lee would next see action at Cerro Gordo in mid-April of 1847. The Mexican force there was positioned in a very defensible location. Their right was protected by what amounted to an unclimbable rock wall and the river that ran alongside it, and the left was protected by deep ravines. The main road that led to the center was defended by 35 cannons. Lee's scouting mission was to find a pathway that would allow for a turning movement on the Mexican right, and this mission resulted in what must have been one of the most unnerving experiences of his career. Lee was out scouting alone and on foot. He was searching for a way through what appeared to be impassable rock when he stopped for a drink of water at a small stream. Now, the stream that he found must have been a well-known watering hole because he soon heard voices speaking Spanish, and he didn't have much choice but to drop to the ground and hide behind a fallen log. Had he been captured, he would almost certainly have been shot or at least taken prisoner, neither of which were very attractive options. So throughout the afternoon and evening, more and more Mexican soldiers came and went, sometimes even sitting on the log that Lee was hiding behind, while Lee was repeatedly bitten and stung by all sorts of different insects, but dared not make any sort of noise or movements. He made it through to the night, and when darkness came, Lee was able to sneak back to the American lines and tell Scott that he had found a path that would allow access to the Mexican right, and therefore enable them to make the turning maneuver. As it turns out, the path that Lee found was the same path that the soldiers Lee had encountered had been walking on when they visited the stream. So needless to say, Winfield Scott was thrilled with Lee's report and promptly sent him back out with a team of men tasked with widening the path sufficiently to allow for the passage of artillery and cavalry. This is going to be a recurring theme we're going to see with Lee's scouting, where Scott sends him out to scout. Lee has some adventures, comes back with some information, and Scott's happy but tells him, get your butt back out there. In a single night, Lee and his team were able to widen the path as they had been ordered without attracting attention from the Mexican forces. The next day, Lee was ordered to serve as a guide to a division under General David Twiggs that would make the flanking maneuver. They marched silently, and they were able to surprise and defeat a small force that had been positioned on a hill on the Mexican right and seize the strategic high ground. Mexican General Santa Anna, who was present in person at the battle, ordered a counterattack to retake the hill. The attack was repulsed, and the battle ended up in what amounted to a rout. Afterwards, General Twiggs praised Lee's efforts in his report, and Scott wrote, quote, I am impelled to make special mention of the services of Captain R.E. Lee, Engineers. This officer, greatly distinguished at the Siege of Veracruz, was again indefatigable during these operations and reconnaissance, as daring as laborious, and of the utmost value. Unquote. For his part, Lee wrote of Cerro Gordo in a letter to his son Custis. Custis was 15 at the time. The letter stated in part, quote, You have no idea what a horrible sight a field of battle is. Unquote. During the battle, Lee had reportedly saved a Mexican drummer boy who had been wounded and then stuck under a fallen soldier. So perhaps saving this Mexican drummer boy had led Lee to have thoughts about his own son. After Cerro Gordo, Santa Anna hastily retreated back to the fortifications of Mexico City. Lee had received a brevet promotion to major after the battle and was then again assigned to reconnaissance by Scott. The main approach to Mexico City was protected by El Peñon, which was a 300-foot-high fortified hill with 30 artillery pieces and which was manned by 7,000 soldiers. Scott knew better than to risk a frontal assault on that sort of fortification, so instead of advancing toward El Peñon, on August 18th, Scott ordered Lee to find a way through El Pedregal. El Pedregal was a 5-mile-wide area of sharp volcanic terrain to the south of Mexico City. One of Lee's fellow officers had described it as, quote, utterly impassable by artillery, cavalry, or single horsemen, unquote. And Santa Anna and his officers believed that El Pedregal was utterly impenetrable. So if it could be passed, it would allow for an attack at the point where the city's defenses were weakest. Lee was joined in this scouting project by another future Confederate full general by the name of P.G.T. Beauregard. The two were able to find a narrow path through and were ordered to return with 500 men, including a young artilleryman named Thomas J. Jackson and an engineering team which included McClellan, in order to turn the path into a passable road. The team was soon spotted and they came under heavy artillery fire from a larger Mexican force. Taking heavy fire, the team was able to find a path out of El Pedregal, but now found themselves directly in between the Mexican force that they had just been fighting and additional reinforcements which had been sent by Santa Anna from the city's main defenses after he had learned of the operation. They were only saved by darkness and a terrific storm. The officers met that night during the storm, and they came up with a plan for a night march to circle back behind the first defending force so they weren't stuck in the middle anymore. After the meeting, Lee volunteered to try to make his way back to Scott. Now, he would be traveling alone in the dark in a really bad storm and through some very harsh terrain for the purpose of requesting a diversionary strike. Lee did manage to find his way back, and he met with Scott, and then Scott in turn directed General Twiggs to position his force for the diversionary attack first thing in the morning. Lee then would serve as their guide through the dark and stormy night to get him in position for the attack. The attack was executed as well as it possibly could have been expected under the circumstances, and it resulted in saving the formerly stranded 500-man team, minus the casualties that had been sustained in the prior night's fighting. And they also managed to gain a foothold through the strong defenses into Mexico City proper. Once again, Scott heaped tons of praise on Lee, and he described his conduct as, quote, the greatest feat of physical and moral courage performed by any individual, in my knowledge, pending the campaign, unquote. So as you can see from this and the prior statements, Winfield Scott is really beginning to think highly of Robert E. Lee. There was a brief and unsuccessful armistice declared on August 23rd. Peace terms could not be reached, and so Mexico City again prepared for battle. Once again, Lee was ordered to recon duty, this time around a castle that was situated on high ground to the west of the city, known as Chapultepec. The castle hosted the Mexican Military Academy and was thought to be virtually impregnable, though Scott was not convinced. His plan called for a feint toward the city's southern defenses, which was where Santa Anna anticipated the attack would come from, and so had therefore focused his defenses. But the main attack was going to come from the west near Chapultepec. So taking Chapultepec would be absolutely necessary for any chance of success. If the castle doesn't fall, the attack's going to fail. Lee was ordered to supervise the construction of the gun batteries that would begin the assault on the castle. After a day of artillery fire, which was supposed to soften up the defenses, the infantry assault commenced on September 12th. By all accounts, the fighting at Chapultepec was very fierce and very bloody. This was in addition to small arms fighting. There was fighting with bayonets, fighting with knives, and hand-to-hand fighting. Along with Lee, present at Chapultepec were Thomas J. Jackson, who we mentioned earlier, U.S. Grant, James Longstreet, and George Pickett. Longstreet and Pickett would end up carrying the U.S. flag that eventually sailed over the castle. During the battle, Lee was charged with riding back and forth from the battle throughout the day and providing Scott with continuous updates on the fighting. So between his recon work and the construction of the artillery batteries and reporting to Scott, Lee hadn't had the chance to sleep in over 50 hours. After Chapultepec fell, Lee joined Scott in riding into the city. As they arrived, Lee, absolutely overcome by exhaustion, collapsed in the saddle. This would mark the end of his duty for the day, and as it turns out, his duty for the Mexican War. So Winfield Scott, who was a distinguished soldier in his own right and who had been in service since 1808, and so therefore was a guy who was really in a position to tell the wheat from the chaff, he had been thoroughly impressed with Lee's service in Mexico. At one point, he described Lee as, quote, "the very best soldier that I ever saw in the field," unquote. Lee had received several brevet promotions throughout the Mexican campaign, which raised his rank from captain to lieutenant colonel and then to full colonel, though his permanent rank did technically remain captain due to the temporary nature of brevet promotions. Immediately after the war, Lee was stationed at Fort Carroll in Baltimore, though he would continue to go on surveying and mapping expeditions throughout the country. In 1852, Lee was appointed as superintendent of West Point, which was his alma mater. Lee was initially reluctant to take the position, though ultimately he felt that he was compelled by duty to honor the War Department's wishes. It was a difficult assignment for him due to the separation from his family, who had remained in Virginia, though they did visit occasionally. Lee's eldest son, George Washington Custis Lee, who went by Custis, and this is the son that Lee was writing to after Cerro Gordo, Custis attended West Point during Lee's time as superintendent, and he graduated at the top of the class of 1854. And so this situation really makes you wonder what the dynamic would have been like between Robert and Custis at the time. You know, when for example, a coach has their kid on the Little League team, or the teachers have their kids in class, they always say that they're going to try to treat all the kids the same as the others, but no one can ever really pull that off. Sometimes, you know, they're much harder on their kid than the other kid, and sometimes there's some blatant favoritism. Now, I tend to think that Lee would have been the type that holds his kid to the higher standards, but I guess you never know. Jeb Stuart, who would later serve as Lee's cavalry commander, had also been a cadet while Lee was superintendent. However, unlike either of the Lees, Stuart earned quite a few demerits. We'll have to do a future episode on Stuart. He seems to have been quite a character with a pretty well-developed sense of humor. Lee was again promoted in 1855, this time to a position as second in command of the 2nd Cavalry at Camp Cooper, Texas, under Colonel Albert Sidney Johnston. Now, Johnston was a Kentucky-born Texan who would go on to command the Confederate Western Forces until he was killed in the fierce fighting at Shiloh. Their mission in Texas was to protect settlers from attacks by the hostile Apache and Comanche warriors there. Lee reportedly was glad to leave the Engineering Corps and assume a combat position. In 1857, Lee's wealthy father-in-law died, which left Lee in an unwished-for position as executor of the will. George Washington Parke Custis's estate included enormous land holdings, including the plantation at Arlington, along with hundreds of slaves, who, by the terms of the will, were to be emancipated within 5 years of Custis's death. Lee expressed some frustration with the situation. He preferred the military life, but he wasn't able to find a suitable substitute to act as executor, so he had to do it himself. And this kind of is as good of a time as any to venture into what's the somewhat contentious issue of Lee's feelings towards slavery. Lee's supporters note that he supported his wife and mother-in-law's efforts towards emancipation and relocation of slaves to Liberia. Also, Lee's wife and daughter, presumably with Lee's support, had also established a school for slaves on the Arlington plantation, which was a practice that was illegal in Virginia at the time. Lee's supporters also note that Lee did in fact emancipate Custis's slaves at the designated time in 1862, and to his support for a Confederate policy that would provide slaves with their freedom in return for their service in the Southern military. Now, Lee's detractors point to an 1859 incident in which Lee allegedly ordered the whipping of three slaves who had run away from the Arlington plantation and who had been apprehended near the Pennsylvania border. Now, this incident is subject to some dispute. Some say that the incident didn't happen at all, And some say that Lee was actually the one that held the whip. That would be a little out of character to both Lee personally and to someone that was in his social station. Realistically, the truth is probably that Lee did order the whipping, but did not administer it himself. So I suppose you could say that in this case, he fails Ned Stark's maxim that he who passes the sentence should be the one who swings the sword. Lee's detractors also point to the somewhat obvious fact that Lee fought on the side in the Civil War whose purpose, ultimately, boiled down to the preservation of slavery as an institution. It seems like the most fair way to handle it, though, is to let Lee's words speak for themselves. And so I'm going to read from a letter that he wrote to his wife on December 27th, 1856. Lee writes to his wife as follows, quote, "In this enlightened age, there are few, I believe, but we will acknowledge that slavery as an institution is a moral and political evil in any country. It is useless to expatiate on its disadvantages. I think it, however, a greater evil to the white man than to the black man, and while my feelings are strongly enlisted in behalf of the latter, my sympathies are more strong for the former. The blacks are immeasurably better off here than in Africa, morally, socially, and physically. The painful discipline they are undergoing is necessary for their instruction as a race, and I hope will prepare and lead them to better things. How long their subjugation may be necessary is known and ordered by a wise, merciful providence." Unquote. And again, that's Robert E. Lee to Mary Anna Lee, December 27, 1856. Also, after the Civil War, and I believe this is from when Lee testified before Congress about the war and about Reconstruction, he's quoted as saying, quote, "So far from engaging in a war to perpetuate slavery, I am rejoiced that slavery is abolished. I believe it will be greatly for the interests of the South." Unquote. So without delving too far into commentary or speculation, in his note to his wife, Lee displays what can only be characterized as an undeniably paternalistic attitude, though he does acknowledge that slavery is inherently immoral and politically wrong. Now, Lee was most certainly not an abolitionist, though his views here seem to not differ very much from Abraham Lincoln's at the time. So if Lee saw slavery as a moral and political evil, and rejoiced when it had been abolished, why then would he fight on a side seeking to preserve slavery? Now, the answer to that question, I think, is that that was not the question at all as Lee saw it framed. And that's a point that we're going to return to shortly. In October of 1859, an abolitionist by the name of John Brown led a group of fellow abolitionists in seizing the federal armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, which is now located in West Virginia, along the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah rivers. President James Buchanan gave Lee command of a contingent of Marines that were tasked with retaking Harper's Ferry and capturing John Brown and his group. Fortunately for James Buchanan, Lee had been on leave from his position in Texas and was able to lead up the mission on short notice. Brown refused to surrender after Lee's forces had surrounded the abolitionist group, and so Lee ordered an attack. After a few minutes of fighting, Brown was captured along with the rest of his group, other than the 10 who died in the fighting. In his report on the incident, Lee described it as, quote, "the attempt of a fanatic or madman," unquote. Afterwards, Brown was tried for treason, then hanged on December 2nd. On the day of his execution, he issued these prophetic words, quote, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. I had, as I now think vainly, flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done," unquote. And as a little side note, if you were ever in the eastern panhandle area of West Virginia or in western Maryland, I highly recommend that you visit the Harper's Ferry National Historical Park. There's some well-preserved historic sites in the town itself, and the surrounding areas offer some excellent hiking and kayaking opportunities. The only real drawback is that it can be tough to find a place to park sometimes, but it's worth the trouble, and I highly recommend visiting Harper's Ferry. After Harper's Ferry, Lee was posted at Fort Brown, Texas, at the rank of lieutenant colonel. Texas seceded in February 1861, and then General David E. Twiggs, who you'll remember Lee served under in Mexico, who had been commanding the fort, surrendered the fort to Texas, resigned from the United States Army, and became a Confederate general. Lee, on the other hand, returned to Washington, where he accepted his final position in the United States Army, which was a promotion to Colonel of the 1st Cavalry Regiment, and was signed by new President Abraham Lincoln in March of 1861. Lee was then offered another promotion, this time to Major General, 3 weeks later as the United States Army expanded in preparation for the anticipated fight against the seceding states. Winfield Scott, who we all remember had a very high opinion of Lee, who was still the highest-ranking Union officer before the war, but who was no longer physically capable of commanding in the field, he told Lincoln that he wanted Lee in a top command position. Lincoln's advisor, Francis Blair, who would incidentally later go on to be one of General George McClellan's few advocates close to Lincoln, presented Lee with an offer of senior command of the U.S. Army. Lee responded as follows, quote, "Mr. Blair, I look upon secession as anarchy. If I owned the 4 million of slaves in the South, I would sacrifice them all to the Union. But how can I draw my sword upon Virginia, my native state?" Unquote. So Lee's personal opinion was that the country should remain united. He opposed secession. In a letter to his eldest son, Custis, written in early 1861, Lee said, quote, "I can anticipate no greater calamity for the country than a dissolution of the Union. It would be an accumulation of all the evils we complain of, and I am willing to sacrifice everything but honor for its preservation. I hope, therefore, that all constitutional means will be exhausted before there is a resort to force. Secession is nothing but revolution. The framers of our Constitution never exhausted so much labor, wisdom, and forbearance in its formation, and surrounded it with so many guards and securities, if it was intended to be broken by every member of the Confederacy at will. It was intended for perpetual union, so expressed in the preamble, and for the establishment of a government, not a compact, which can only be dissolved by revolution or the consent of all the people in convention assembled." Unquote. Lee's initial inclination seems to have been to try to stay out of the coming war altogether. He met with Scott, and we can't be 100% sure everything that the two men discussed, but it appears that Scott advised Lee that neutrality was not an option. So despite his strong feelings in opposition to secession, Lee believed that his first loyalty belonged to his home state of Virginia. He felt that duty and his personal honor compelled him to defend his home state if attacked. Now remember, the Lees were connected to Virginia. They had emigrated before there even was a United States. And this attitude was fairly common at the time, particularly in the South, where individuals would identify first as citizens of their states rather than as American citizens. Though it wasn't really supported by Lee, the concept of secession, which is the idea that a state could choose to withdraw from the United States, was at the time considered at least a debatable point, with reasonable arguments to be made for and against it. Interestingly, Abraham Lincoln had previously taken a position, albeit in the context of the Mexican-American War, which, when applied to the political situation when Lincoln took office as president, would seem to support the South's right to secession. And this is taken from an 1848 address to the House of Representatives when Lincoln was a member of the House. Lincoln said, quote, "Any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which, we hope and believe, is to liberate the world. Nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people that can, may revolutionize, and make their own of so much of the territory as they inhabit. More than this, a majority of any portion of such people may revolutionize, putting down a minority intermingled with, or near about them, who may oppose their movement, unquote. So following the fighting at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, the Commonwealth of Virginia seceded from the Union on April 17, 1861. So now it's decision time for Lee. He chose to resign from the United States Army on April 20th of 1861 after 30 years of service. In a letter addressed to Scott, Lee said of his resignation, quote, "It would have been presented at once, but for the struggle it has cost me to separate myself from a service to which I have devoted all the best years of my life and all the ability I possessed," unquote. Lee went on, "To no one general have I been as much indebted as to yourself for uniform kindness and consideration, and it has always been my ardent desire to merit your approbation. I shall carry with me to the grave the most grateful recollections of your kind consideration, and your name and fame will always be dear to me. Save in the defense of my native state, I never desire again to draw my sword," unquote. So once again, that's Robert E. Lee, who by the end of the war would end up being the overall commander of all Confederate forces, writing to Winfield Scott, who at the time was the overall commander of all Union forces. And there's quite obviously some affection conveyed in the letter. The two men unquestionably had some fond feelings for one another. So 3 days later, Lee accepted command of the state forces of Virginia, and that was April 23rd. After a Confederate army was formed, Lee was among the initial group of five full generals that were appointed by the new president, Jefferson Davis, and the Confederate Congress. Lee was joined by Samuel Cooper, Albert Sidney Johnston. You remember Johnston was Lee's commander when he was in Texas. Joseph Johnston and P.G.T. Beauregard, who Lee had worked with in the Mexican War and who was then being hailed as the hero of Fort Sumter. Now, by all accounts, Lee had been widely considered as one of the finest officers in the United States Army. And he matched the 1800s profile of what a dashing military commander was supposed to look like. Colonel Arthur Lyon Fremantle, who was a British observer during the 1863 Pennsylvania campaign, said, quote, "General Lee is, almost without exception, the handsomest man of his age I ever saw. He is tall, broad-shouldered, very well made, well set up, a thorough soldier in appearance, and his manners are most courteous and full of dignity. He rides a handsome horse, which is extremely well governed." This is, of course, referring to the famous gray war horse Traveler, who would survive the war and serve Lee for several years thereafter. Fremantle goes on, "In the most arduous marches, he always looks smart and clean. General Lee is a religious man, though not so demonstrative in that respect as Jackson. His only fault, so far as I can tell, arise from his excessive amiability," unquote. Shelby Foote, the very famous Civil War author, describes Lee as having an iron gray beard and active dark brown eyes. Foote goes on to write, quote, "On horseback, deep-chested and long-waisted, with his big leonine head set thick-necked on massive shoulders, he looks gigantic. Partly that was the aura. It must have been, for when he dismounted, as he often did to rest his horse, he had a tender concern for the welfare of all animals, even combat infantrymen. Aside from those times when he flung them into the crackling uproar of battle like chaff into a furnace, you saw the slight legs, the narrow hips, and realized, with something of a shock, that he was no larger than many of the men around him, and not as large as some. The hands were oversized and muscular, the feet tiny as a woman's. He was, in fact, just 6 feet tall and weighed less than 170 pounds. Unquote. Lee would eventually come to be adored by his soldiers. They considered him much less pretentious than some of his fellow officers. He wore a plain gray uniform, which was mostly indistinguishable from a common soldier's, other than the stars affixed to the collar, and he slept in a tent out near his men, rather than taking over a local manor for his headquarters, as was the custom of many other generals during the war. Some of his men even went so far as to compare him to Napoleon in his ability to make the troops that he spoke with feel like trusted old friends. But this love and affection for Lee from his soldiers was going to come later on down the road. And that will bring to a close the first part of our episode on Robert E. Lee. We hope you'll join us soon for part two, where we will see Lee take command of the Army of Northern Virginia and begin to earn his reputation as an aggressive and risk-taking military commander. We'll look at the Seven Days battles, Second Manassas, and then journey north across the Potomac for that bloody showdown along the winding creek known as Antietam. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope to hear from you soon. If you would like to contact Portraits of Blue and Gray, you can reach us by email at blueandgraypodcast@gmail.com. Questions and comments are welcome from Yankees and Secesh alike. And remember, we always spell Gray the old-fashioned way, G-R-E-Y. Visit the show's webpage at portraitsofblueandgray.podbeam.com. If you enjoyed the show and want to contribute financially, click on the Become a Patron badge at the top of the main page to visit our crowdfunding page. Or visit that page directly at patreon.podbeam.com/blueandgray. All contributors are wholeheartedly appreciated and will be thanked by name in an upcoming episode, unless you ask us not to. Please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever other app you used to find us. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again soon.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.